Hello. Before you start this episode of The Game Changers, I wanted to take a moment to tell you about our new documentary, Abby Ward, A Bump in the Road, which explores the challenges faced by professional female athletes and all working mothers. It follows the remarkable journey of an England rugby player as she battles back to the professional game just 17 weeks after the birth of her baby, and then on to secure her place in England's Six Nations squad for 2024. The documentary is free to watch in the UK on ITVX or globally on Rugby Pass TV. And don't forget that our other documentary, Game On, The Unstoppable Rise of Women's Sport, is still available to watch on Netflix in the UK. Now it's time for the Game Changers. Hello and welcome to Series 7 of The Game Changers. It's hard to believe that we've already featured 50 incredible trailblazers in women's sport. I'm your host, Sue Anstis, and I'd like to start with a massive thank you to Barclays for once again sponsoring this series of The Game Changers. Few brands have done more for women's sport. Barclays are title sponsor of the Women's Super League, and they're also backing the FA in the fantastic work it does to ensure that every schoolgirl across the country has the chance to play football by 2024. My guest today is the remarkable Jessica Crichton. Covering everything from Olympic and Commonwealth Games to World Cups and European Championships, this award-winning broadcaster and journalist has worked for a range of renowned organisations, including BBC Sport, Radio 5 Live, BT Sport and TalkSport. Jessica now presents for Sky Sports News and hosts the Women's Football Show on Sky. As a former football player herself, Jess is committed to levelling the playing field and ensuring sport is accessible to all marginalised communities. Her chat show, B is for Black, gives unique insight into the lives and experiences of black and mixed race women in sport. I began by asking Jessica if sport was a part of her life growing up.
Sport has been the single most important thing in my life for as long as I can remember. I feel like I came out the womb with a football at my feet. No one really knows how it happened because my parents, you know, aren't particularly sporty. They like sport, but for me, it was just an obsession from such a young age. There was a story that my mum always tells me when I was younger. I was about 2 years old. She brought me a ball and she threw me the ball. And then rather than catch it, I kind of waited for it to drop on the floor, land at my feet, and I kicked it back to her. And from that moment on, she said, "You've just been obsessed with football." It's just been that one constant in my life. No matter what else was going on in my life, good or bad, football just always been there.
And what level did you play to? Did you play up to as you progressed?
I played at every single level you could imagine. I started in the park with friends in the local area. Then I eventually moved on to a school team. That wasn't easy. The first few schools I went to didn't have a women's team or a girls' team. I was lucky enough that I had a girls' team in one of the local areas that I was around. So that was a godsend. A lot of girls don't have that and therefore drop out. I then got into Charlton Athletics Centre of Excellence / Academy, I suppose you'd call them now, at a very young age. I think I was about 10 or 11. Oh. And then played all the way through for Charlton until I went to uni. And that was kind of just before uni, I had this decision to make. Do you want to try and become a professional footballer, although that wasn't really an option at that time for women to be paid to play and be able to support themselves. So I had a decision to make. Do you want to try and play professionally in the States? Because that was the option. Or do you want to put your brains to some use and perhaps try the academic route instead? And I chose uni. I always wonder, though, what could have been.
Would you make the same decision now?
No way! Not a chance! I would bite someone's hand off to be a professional footballer if I was at that same juncture in the road. Oh, I look at these players now and I just, you know, they've got merchandise deals, they've got sponsorship deals, they get free boots. And it's not even about that. It's just, they have an environment of professionalism where all they have to worry about is playing football. They don't have to think about a part-time job or a full-time job or anything else. They can just concentrate on football. Those at the top level, let's be honest, it's not across the board yet in this country for women. But the top level, you can have a level of professionalism that's unheard of in England and be paid, so you don't have to worry about anything else. I couldn't think of anything just more exciting, more rewarding, but alas.
Are you still playing now?
Playing, interesting word, playing. I try, Sue. I do try. But, you know, I think I would always play in some respect. I don't have a team at the moment. I play five-a-side with a few other women and guys, actually. It's a mixed five-a-side team. A few of them you might have heard of, a certain Eni Aluko player. You might have heard of them. Anyway, they're part of the five-a-side group that plays every week.
Wow.
Yeah, right? Way to get confidence back is playing against former England internationals, let me tell you. It's not easy. But yeah, I it was one of my New Year's resolutions for 2021 to rejoin.
I saw that on your lovely video.
Will it happen? I hope so, after lockdown perhaps.
Excellent, excellent. And what first triggered your interest in journalism? So did you have any friends or family that were in the media?
Do you know what, Sue? I'm really an oddball. I had no one that was particularly sporty, no one that particularly liked journalism. No one really knows where I've come from. I always had a love for reading words. I've always been interested in words and how sentences are structured. And I was always quite good at English. It writing came naturally to me. So, you know, my parents suggested to me, what about journalism? But I think at the time I had quite a bad impression of journalists in the media being quite ruthless. Not necessarily telling the truth. So I was put off by that. But then when I realized you can do journalism and combine it with sport, I thought, well, if I'm never going to play for England, maybe I can write about them. And from there, I think it was almost like a no-brainer for me to get involved.
And what was your first step into that world of journalism?
Oh, it started very early on. I actually read an article one time in a very provocative, shall we say, national newspaper. And it really got me angry reading this article because they were blaming video games, setting a bad example to young people. And someone who has always loved video games, I thought, well, I'm able to make that distinction. And I think what they're doing is quite reductive in their analysis. And it got me really angry. And I was only, 14? So I wrote a reply, funnily enough, never got a response. Then I also sent it off to a newspaper that's got a very high standing within the Black community, The Voice, because I was like, well, someone needs to read this. Let me send it to The Voice. And The Voice got back to me after reading that response and invited me in for some voluntary kind of work experience and said, why don't you come in and have a talk with some of the journalists here? You seem like you've got a bit of a knack for it. And that was when I was 14. So I guess it started from there. But I did also study broadcast journalism at university as well.
And how well did that degree prepare you, do you think, for working within the media at Nottingham, wasn't it?
Yeah, Nottingham Trent. What a fantastic uni that was. It was a great 3 years. It did prepare me very well because it was a course that was 50% practical and 50% theory based. And that practical was really, I think, what gave me the edge, because they taught you how to edit audio, how to film videos, how to edit video as well. And those were all skills I would need as soon as I graduated. It just naturally put me top of the pile, which was brilliant.
And can you tell us a little bit about the prestigious BBC journalism training scheme that you were a part of?
Ah, yes, that was fantastic. So after graduating, I got to that point in life where I think many graduates get to and they think, what on earth am I going to do now? There are no jobs. And even if there are jobs, they don't pay you. So I was kind of milling around for a while, working jobs that weren't very glamorous whilst I worked out my next move. And then I heard about the journalism trainee scheme. But the one thing I didn't realize, Sue, is that this course is very prestigious. I didn't realize how prestigious at the time, which I think was an advantage, because I would have freaked out had I known 3,000 other people were also going for one of these 15 placements. So I'm very lucky in that respect that I was able to keep a lid on things, on my emotions. But it was a very thorough process. You know, there was,
I can imagine,
10 essay questions you had to answer about yourself, about life, about the industry you were going into, scenarios. That if you got through that, we were then invited to an assessment day where you had a general knowledge quiz. You were put in front of a camera to screen test. You were then invited into an interview with a good cop, bad cop. Fascinating. And then if you got through that, there was a telephone interview. And then if you got through that, you got one of the 15 places.
Wow. And how did you progress from that into the world of sport?
So after getting a place on that BBC trainee scheme, nothing was guaranteed. They put you in placements for 12 months all around the BBC, up and down the country. The opportunity came up to work in Norwich. No, I did not want to move to Norwich in my mid-20s, but I did because I thought it would be good career-wise. You know, you have to weigh up whether it's worth making that sacrifice. There are a lot of sacrifices that have to be made in this industry if you're going to progress. So I moved to Norwich and, you know, basically throughout those 12 months, got a better understanding of the BBC, of the media industry, and what my strengths and weaknesses are. But then after that 12 months, nothing, as I say, was guaranteed to us. So it was up to us to apply for jobs within the organization, put ourselves forward, contact bosses and, you know, find out if there's any openings. And basically, as soon as I got a BBC email, Sue, I harassed every single boss I could get my hands on. I looked them up. I wonder if any of these bosses remember how much I must have been a pain in their backsides. But I emailed and emailed and emailed. And I think eventually that's what helped me out, because people began to realize who I was, that I was always open to do things, was always willing to work 7-8 days a week. It felt like sometimes 25 hours a day. And I think, you know, that stood me in good stead when I applied for bosses. One of the bosses I did harass was someone from BBC Sport. And they eventually asked me to do placements at the weekend. I was working Monday to Friday at World News at the time. And then Saturday, Sunday, I'd work at BBC Sport. And I think through building relationships there, doing a good job and getting to know people, I think that helped me when I then applied for a job within BBC Sport after my traineeship. So it was fantastic. It all worked out really well.
And you were an Olympic sports reporter, I believe, this way, London 2012. So what was that like to work on London 2012?
A dream, Sue. Just a dream. It was just fantastic. And what it meant was for me, that role meant that I could build relationships with these athletes that were going to the biggest Olympics of their life in their home country. I could build a relationship with them and follow them around to their training camps and maybe meet their families and see what life was like for them before they went to London 2012. And then when they were at London 2012, I got to follow that experience as well, to be there at the London Olympics. It was just such a fantastic time. And I pinch myself saying this now, but I was there for Super Saturday in the Olympic Stadium when Jessica Ennis-Hill, Greg Rutherford and Mo Farah won their gold medals. And to this day, I still can't believe what I witnessed.
And it must have been such a massive highlight so early in your career. So kind of where do you go to from there, really?
It's a good question, Sue. I think it's all gone downhill. No, I think I peaked very, very early. It was a fantastic, fantastic job that I had. But I then went to another Olympics, so I can't complain too much. To experience a South American multi-sport event like the Olympics in Rio de Janeiro was, again, another highlight of my career. So I won't say I've peaked. I hope there's more to come. You know, those were fantastic experiences very early on in my career that I'm so grateful for.
And how did you end up at Sky?
I tell you one thing, if I'm honest, one thing that's always been, I suppose, difficult is knowing how to maneuver yourself in an industry that is so competitive and so traditional. They don't necessarily embrace what's different. So I think it got to a point where I realized there's no amount of harassing bosses I can do at that point to perhaps do what I wanted to do as a broadcaster. And so I think it was time for a change and time for a move where perhaps there would be more opportunities.
And among many other things, you host the Women's Football Show on the Sky, which I love. How is that going and what are future plans for the show? Is that progressing?
Yeah, it really is. I think traditionally the Sky Sports audience isn't used to seeing women's football. So to be able to build that rapport with a new section of society has been such a privilege. And to bring people, you know, not just results, but debate, analysis on the women's game. It's something that I think has been missing for quite a while. And I love the fact that I'm at the forefront of it. And, you know, I have to shout out Sue Smith, who's my co-host on that show. She's absolutely fantastic, a pleasure to work with, and has so much knowledge. She just makes the show fantastic. And it's such a joy to work on that team. And I have to say as well, the team behind the scenes is majority female, which doesn't happen to me very often in this industry. So again, I think, you know, that's worth pointing out. The fact that I get to speak about women's football day in, day out, I mean, come on. That's a highlight. That's another highlight for me.
I think you feel that coming through. I think definitely with you and Sue and that balance, I think you feel that as the audience. And how important do you think it was for you to have that show, as you say, that was purely dedicated to women's football? And how different is it for you presenting a show on women's football than on the men's side?
Yes, I think for me, as someone who is always in support of women in general, regardless if they're women in sport, women in general, I'm so keen on providing women a platform if I can, sharing my platform with women, diversifying the types of women that we hear from in the public sphere. So this show for me is just the perfect match. And I think one thing that is different about talking about men's football and talking about women's football, because of the history of women's football, because it has been so knocked, so judged, so criticized for so many years, you have to look at it through a different lens. I'm not saying that I'm here to just spread, you know, absolute positivity about the women's game. There are things that need to change. There are things that are wrong. There are things where people need to be held to account. Of course, I would do that as a journalist. But at the same time, I think the women's game is at a very different point in its history to the men's game. It's been held back for years. There was a 50-year ban in England. You know, the women's game is still recovering from that. And I think with that lens on, it allows you to see the women's game slightly differently. And perhaps you can't be as critical as you would be of the men's game.
And does that imbalance in the coverage, general coverage of women's sport, frustrate you?
Oh, Sue, I'm frustrated by many things, and that is yes, it does. It's very easy for all of us to just throw our hands up and say, oh my god, women are playing football, it's not as fast, it's not as good, it's not as popular, it's not as, you know, there's not as much money involved, what's the point? It's easy to say that, but let's try and understand why all those things, if they are true, have come to be. Let's look at it from, you know, a more well-rounded point of view. There's a reason for all of those things. And actually, I would argue that it is just as good as the men's game. Perhaps, you know, it might not be as quick. But if you were comparing two greats of the game, you know, if you compare Ronaldo to Messi, they're two completely different players. Doesn't mean that they're both good. I would want Ronaldo's athleticism, but then I would want Messi's technical ability and quick feet. They have different attributes. The women's game has different attributes to the men's game. It doesn't mean it's any worse. But also, it's not as developed. Men have been playing for centuries, have money flooded into it. The women's game hasn't had that yet. So once again, you know, as I say, they're at a different stage of their development. And I think sometimes the coverage, the media coverage around the women's game is a bit lazy. You know, it's a bit simplistic. I think we need to be a bit more thorough in our analysis sometimes.
And do you see things changing in terms of the amount that's broadcast and also the quality of production? I mean, your own show itself, but more widely across the media.
Yeah, things are changing a lot. You know, there was a time where I would turn up to an England women's camp and be the only person from the media there. Just me and my little camera trying to grab a player as they're walking off the pitch or grab Hope Power if she agreed to talk to me. just seeing what I could get. And, you know, I'd be the only one that maybe not cared, but I was the only one, you know, putting myself in that position to get interviews and things like that. And that wasn't that long ago. That was less than 10 years ago.
Yeah.
Now, I remember being at the World Cup, France 2019. What an incredible World Cup that was. What an incredible tournament. And there was one England media press conference and the room was absolutely packed. There was nowhere for anyone to stand or sit. It was that busy. There must have been plus of 200 people in that room. And I just thought, from when it was just me with my little camera filming stuff, hopeful that I could get it on the BBC Sport website, to this, absolutely incredible. So it's come a long, long way. But let's not, you know, let's not sugarcoat it. We've got a long way to go.
I was so proud to present you with the Sports Journalist of the Year Award at the Women's Sport Trust Be a Game Changer event back in 2015. I looked at it nearly 6 years ago, which is extraordinary, isn't it? But how important do you feel it is to be publicly recognised in that way?
Oh, I don't know. I'm a bit conflicted with recognition, Sue. I still don't believe I won that. I think you probably know sense that when I came on stage and my mouth was like, so wide open, what a fantastic evening. You know, public recognition, I don't know. I can't say that I'm not grateful for it, because I am, but I suppose it's just not what drives me. Sometimes I feel guilty about accepting public recognition because that's not what I'm here for. But also I feel like there's other people that have been, you know, carrying these, fighting this cause for a lot longer than me, that perhaps deserve more recognition than I'm getting.
But you're clearly an extraordinary role model for young women of colour wanting to work in the media. You're also a mentor for the Journalism Diversity Fund too. Do you see the impact you're having? How does that make you feel when you are able to mentor others and bring women kind of through as an example?
To me, this is probably a part of my personality, but to me, I'm never making enough impact because things still need to change. Yeah, you know, I'm a bit of a perfectionist, I suppose. Probably never really satisfied with things. But I don't know. Impact is subjective, isn't it? It's, you know, have I had impact? Have I been successful? I don't know. I think there's so much more I could do yet. But also to answer your question, what, you know, one of my key objectives is to allow for young women in particular to enter this industry feeling like it's possible to get to where they want to go. I always say that if I'm not here to make it that little bit easier for the women underneath me wanting to be in this industry, whether that's on screen or off screen, if I haven't made it a little bit easier for them, a little bit more accessible, then I failed. And so far, I'm not convinced I've done that. So I just keep my head down and carry on. I don't know.
That's so interesting. That's your opinion of yourself, but not necessarily of others watching you and seeing all you're doing. Social media obviously can have such a negative influence on women on our screens, especially sports journalists and pundits and so on. How do you personally deal with that? And is there any advice you'd share for other women in that situation?
Yes. As soon as you're getting negative vibes from social media, get out. Get out, run away, turn it off, turn your notifications off, delete the apps from your phone, whatever you need to do, get off it. It's not the real world. It can suck you into this vortex of negativity and insecurity. I've been in a situation where I feel like it's so real. Everyone's achieving. Everyone's successful. Everyone's having a jolly good time. It's really not real. Get yourself off it. Have a break. It's refreshing and it's liberating.
Fantastic. I love that. It's brilliant advice. If we take you back to this summer, I think for myself included, a real wake-up call following the murder of George Floyd. And it felt to me that you took a very central role in educating and sharing your thoughts on racial equality and unapologetically and with real honesty. So how tough was that for you to be so public and share your feelings in that way?
Speaking out and being myself was one of the hardest things I've done in my career. Speaking out and being myself about an issue that's so personal was really, really tough. And I sat down and I thought about it for a long time and thought, you know, what role am I going to play here? Because it could have been one where I just retweet what other people are saying or don't say anything, you know, because to engage with that level of trauma, it's debilitating, to be honest with you, Sue. It's really debilitating. But what I've noticed about myself is that I see a challenge and I'm like, well, come on then. bring it on. I don't, again, I don't know where that comes from. It's in me. And so I made the decision that I just wanted to be honest with people. I wanted to show people that for everything that I might have achieved or all the success that they think they see, it's taken a lot out of me, you know. It's taken a lot of hard work, yes, but also there's been so many obstacles, both obvious and insidious barriers to my journey in my career. And I just wanted to shed a spotlight on that, I guess. And so people were aware of the journey. And I know that there were so many women within the industry could relate. And I thought, well, you know, if not me, who?
And you launched the Be Is for Black YouTube channel, which I love those.
I think a lot of people weren't used to seeing that side of me, Sue. And I think that was, I was very direct in that because I was talking to people with who had a similar experience to my own. So I think it allowed me to relax a little bit and put my guard down. But I do wonder what people thought of that that aren't black, in case they did think it was a bit too forthcoming.
Yeah, no, I loved it. And I think also the people that you had, it just felt very natural. It felt like friends talking about something that they were passionate and emotional about. And I think so for me, yeah, got huge insight from it too. Is that something you will look to continue? Is that something you're hoping will continue?
Yeah, I would love to. I think the support and the praise and the feedback's been so good, quite overwhelming. I was blown away by it, actually. And, you know, yeah, like you say, I wanted to provide a platform for black women, mixed race women who had similar experiences, who had something to say, who didn't feel like they could speak about this necessarily in the mainstream. So let's have a relaxed conversation amongst our peers. Like, let's do it that way. But also I wanted to give insight to people that aren't from the black community, to give just a bit of information on what we're going through, like what we've been through and what we're still going through to this day.
And a few months on, do you feel that momentum for change that we saw and you began to talk about is continuing?
Oh, I don't know, Sue, you know. I go through periods of thinking, right, everyone's on it. We're all heading towards a collective solution. And then other times I just think, oh, people don't care. Like, black people have been pouring their hearts out to their colleagues, to their bosses, to their friends, to their family for the last few months in particular, but for years before this. But nothing's happening, nothing's changing. I suppose I'm always one of those people that wants to see tangible change. I don't want to hear people talking about it anymore. What is there to talk about? I've also noticed in the last few months how impatient I am as a person as well. So perhaps that plays into it. But I'm not convinced the momentum is still there, sadly. But I suppose from my point of view, I'm going to do all I can as an individual to ensure that this remains top of the agenda. And it's not just, you know, for me personally, yes, I am black, but it's not just racial diversity that I want to change. In terms of the LGBTQ community, figures within the media industry are shockingly low. Gender is terrible. 25% of front page newspapers are written by women. Not good enough. Just 0.4% of the media industry is Muslim. Not good enough. There's a lot I want to change that isn't just about race. And I think we need an intersectional approach for that. I don't think we can just block, right, today we're going to talk about race. And then, the next day, okay, now it's about gender. You need to look at it from a more holistic point of view, in my opinion.
I completely agree. And I was going to come on to that, actually. You've also featured on the Football Blacklist, celebrating influential people within football. And last year you called for the Blacklist to add a further award. So can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I did. So I called for the Football Blacklist to add the LGBTQ award. I thought it was imperative. I thought it was vital that the LGBT community within football was recognised, was celebrated. I have to say I was a little bit nervous about going to them because I know Rodney and Leon very well, the founders of the Football Blacklist. And I thought, oh, don't know how this is going to go down. I'm not sure if they're going to take it in good spirits, whether they're just going to see it as something else they've got to deal with, you know? And I tell you why I had that opinion. I had that opinion because that's how it seems sometimes when you challenge authority or you challenge leadership within the media industry. They get defensive and they don't want to hear from someone lower down than them. So I had that opinion of perhaps that's how the football blacklist would react. And you know what? It wasn't like that at all. It was open. They were receptive. There was no problem. They said, do you know what? Yeah, I mean, it's going to take some work for us to sort this out. But, you know, rightly so, we haven't acknowledged openly the LGBTQ community. And we need to do that, simple as. And I just thought, wow, do you know what I mean? That is such a brilliant example of leadership. You know, no airs and graces about it. Leon basically said, yeah, you're right. We were wrong. Let's change it.
How refreshing.
I was so proud. So, so proud of the Football Blacklist that day when I had that conversation with Leon. So proud of my community wanting to stand up for the LGBTQ community. And that's not always the case. So it was heartwarming. Honestly, it was quite emotional.
You've been such a strong voice for the LGBTQ community, and you also co-founded Rainbow Noir. So another thing to add to your day time of doing things, a community space for LGBTQ people of colour. I think if you talk about football generally, so it's obviously got a real reputation around homophobia, but primarily within the men's game. So what, and it's a huge topic, isn't it? But what do you think needs to change systematically so that all players can be comfortable to live their lives more honestly on both male and female side of the game?
Yeah, I think you're right to point out the distinction between the men's and the women's game. Whilst the women's game isn't exempt from its issues around homophobia and other issues, it tends to be a lot more open and accepting of same-sex relationships. Whereas the men's game really isn't. And I think it's reflective of a society that promotes masculinity in a way that's almost toxic. If we look at society, there are people within the LGBT community who to this day are being abused, who, you know, are being physically and verbally abused for who they decide to be in a relationship with. So that is reflected in football, which tends to be, on the male side of things, quite a macho culture. There's no space for anything other than masculinity and heteronormativity, it seems. And that is the problem. I'm not convinced that football is going to fix that issue before society fixes the issue. And society is nowhere near. So I think male football has a long way to go. What does concern me, though, is this witch hunt to find the first male Premier League footballer that's going to come out. I think it's damaging, it's reductive, and it's very counterintuitive to creating an environment of acceptance and inclusivity. And ultimately, it doesn't matter. But, you know, some sections of the media annoyingly persist with this idea that they need to find a male Premier League player to come out.
Yes, they've become fixated on it, haven't they? As you say, to the exclusion of the whole system. And society changing, really.
Totally, sir. I agree with that, yes.
There's no doubt, as you've mentioned, that sports journalism is still pretty much dominated with straight, white, middle-class men, primarily. How tough has it been for you as a black woman reporting on sport? I know you've said in the past your multiple identities, so being young and gay and black and female, have been used against you in the past. Can you tell us, a little bit more about how you feel from your...
It's a lot of identities, isn't it? My goodness.
You're carrying it for everybody.
Oh my gosh. God, don't tell them I grew up on a council estate as well, Sue. My goodness. You know, it's hard to answer that question just because I don't know it any other way. I almost feel like I've just been fighting a cause all my life, for as long as I can remember. So to get into the real world after university and fight my cause in the media industry just felt like, well, yeah, of course I'm going to have to fight. Like, it's never been any different. I remember even at school, I wasn't even 10 years old, and someone told me that as a girl attending that school, I wasn't allowed to wear trousers. And I thought, hold on a minute, what? I can't wear trousers, but this same human being who wants to wear trousers but just happens to be a boy can wear trousers? I couldn't understand it. I could not get my head around it, Sue. So I was like, well, no, that's not going to, it can't be that way. So, you know, started a campaign at school before I was even 10 years old. So it's just always been in me from a young age to just fight. And I think I know where it comes from in that we've had a lot of time to reflect in these last 12 months because of lockdown and quarantine and self-isolation. And what drives me at the very root of my need to fight for a cause is unfairness. I cannot stand unfairness. That to me, not being able to wear trousers whilst that young person who just happened to be a boy could wear trousers was unfair. And it incensed me enough to want to fight it. When I see that the media industry is 94% white, particularly in London, that does not reflect the communities that use that media, I find that unfair. I want to fight it. When I feel like women are being degraded and not given the opportunities they deserve simply because they're women, I find it unfair and I can't get past it. And perhaps one day it will drive me to madness or, you know, drive me to a nervous breakdown. But for now, I can't find any other way but to fight to be able to try and change things.
It does feel like in researching you, you're quite a private person in terms of your personal life. And yet you do speak up for women and women of colour and the LGBTQ plus community. Is it hard to maintain that balance of being private and being so vocal too?
Yes, it is. And it's something that I weigh up in my mind all the time because, you know, essentially when I'm interviewing people, I'm asking them to tell me their private thoughts and feelings. And I always feel like if you were to ask me this question, I wouldn't answer it. Don't tell my interviewees that. Maybe we should cut that bit out. No, you know, I just, you know, I wrestle with that all the time. And, you know, there's this thing when you talk to agents, they're like, you know, show your vulnerable side on social media. Show them everyone that you're not all glitz and glamour. Show that. And I do, but there's certain things that I think I don't want to share. You know, I don't talk about my family much, not for any particular reason, but just because I know that once I open my family up to social media, everyone thinks, right, game on. We can now dive into their lives. And I don't want that for them. They, you know, they deserve, they haven't chosen this life. They haven't chosen to be in the public eye. So for me, it's not wanting to drag them into this world that they haven't chosen to be a part of.
Indeed. I'm going to move on just towards the end now in terms of back to presenting, I guess, and the role that you've taken. So how do you feel that sports presenting's changed? You've been in this business for over a decade now. Have you seen it change in terms of sports presenting?
I suppose it's had to adapt, you know, with changing technologies, social media. What I find now is there are many more competitors. So before, Sky's competitor could have been, I don't know, Satanta Sports and the BBC. Now it's not Satanta anymore. It's BBC, it's BT. It's every single digital outlet out there, hundreds popping up daily, it almost seems. And also, you know, YouTube channels, fan sites, people on social media that become influencers, they're all trying to grab our audience's attention. And so we've had to be savvy about the way we go about things. That, you know, there's new shows been launched on Sky Sports News recently, like the transfer shows in the last couple of years, you know, more refreshing, more relaxed feel to how you might consider usual Sky Sports News output. And that, you know, that's an attempt to re-engage with our audience that might be distracted elsewhere. So that's been interesting. But I also think more is expected of presenters now. You don't just see a person in a suit telling you what the news is. It's almost like a bit more interactive. We ask for audience engagement now. We ask for your opinion. What do you think about this story? Do you want to hear more about this story or should we move on to another story? And also they want to know more about your personal life. Influencers have made sure that, you know, that has become the norm. There's going to become a time, Sue, where we are all taking selfies whilst we're on the toilet. I'm sure of it. It's not far off.
And what do you think is that secret to being a great sports presenter? What is it that's made you so successful, the way in which you present, that you've had the success you have?
That word again, success. I'm not sure about that, but
you don't like it, do you?
No, I don't know. I just, it's not. Have I? You know, it's so subjective, though, isn't it? It's so subjective. Have I been successful? Not in my eyes. There's so much more that needs to be done. I don't know. What does it take? You know what? It takes passion. I think if the audience can see that you're genuinely having a good time, I think it helps. I really do hope that comes across when I'm talking about sport, because I bloody love it. Honestly, I think, like, I'm being paid to talk about football, rugby, cricket, basketball, like the Olympics. This is bonkers. I think, yeah, you've got to have a passion. Your knowledge has got to be on point, more so if you're a woman, I'm afraid. It shouldn't be that way. That's the way it is, because you will be tested more by the audience and by your colleagues. So knowledge and passion, two of the biggest things that will get you far in this industry, I think.
Fantastic. You were a guest presenter on Woman's Hour last year, which was amazing. So it leads me to the question is, are you interested in pursuing a career outside of sport in the future, or was that a wonderful thing to do? But in terms of your ambitions for the future, where do they sit?
I mean, talk about pinch yourself moments, Sue. When I got an email from Woman's Hour saying, would you like to guest present? I thought, is that even a question? Oh, my goodness, I couldn't believe it. Yeah, what a fantastic experience that was. Yes, I would like to, I suppose, diversify my broadcast skills, because, funnily enough, I have other interests outside of sport. Yes, I love sport. Yes, it's been the one constant throughout my life, but I do have other interests, you know. And going to Woman's Hour was refreshing because it allowed me to talk about other things. I talked about the menopause. I talked about music. I talked about women in the fire service, you know. I got to talk to Oti from Strictly Come Dancing. I just, you know, it's so varied. And it really spoke to me in terms of, you know, fulfilling that part of me outside of sport. So, it would be great to be able to diversify, but, you know, it's a competitive industry. There aren't many opportunities. So, yeah, we'll see.
Watch this space. And finally, what advice would you give to any young women coming into the world of sports media and broadcasting today?
You've got to be able to back yourself. There's going to be so many people that or have an opinion on you as soon as you step in this media industry, particularly if you want to be on screen. You'll have people down the road giving you advice. You'll have randoms in the street, your family, your friends, your colleagues, your bosses. Everyone will want to pick apart what you've done on screen because they feel that's their right as soon as they see you on their TVs. You've got to be ready for that. That's going to happen. You've got to be thick-skinned. Yes, it's easier said than done, but, you know, think about trying to build this resilience, this thick skin in this industry, if you're really serious about coming into it, and back yourself. The majority of the time you're going to get criticism rather than praise. That's been my experience. Maybe that says more about me as a broadcaster than anything else. Because of that, you've got to be able to back yourself. Do you honestly believe that you can do this, even when someone tells you can't? I remember there's been a few moments like that in my career where someone said, it's just, Jess, this isn't possible. You're not gonna be able to do that. And if anything, for me, that just made me say, I'm going to do it and I'm going to do it doubly well. And then I'm going to give you a call after I've done it. So, yeah, resilience, thick skin and backing yourself. But also, like I say, passion. You have to work so hard. You will miss. In my career, I have missed christenings, birthdays of my parents, family occasions, holidays. You can't go for that jolly up to Iron Appa with your mates because you're probably going to be working a big sports tournament in that summer. You're going to miss loads. Are you really ready to make that sacrifice? Are you really ready to work 24 hours a day, 8 days a week? You've got to work hard. That would be the second thing. And the third thing is, if you don't love it, there's no chance in hell. If you have to work that hard, you have to love it as well at the same time, because it will drive you insane if you think you're working 24, 25 hours a day and you don't enjoy it. So yeah, you know, you've got to work hard, sacrifice, you've got to have the passion and enjoyment for it, and you've also got to back yourself.
Wow, what an interview and what an amazing woman. So incredibly humble about all her achievements, yet doing huge amounts for many marginalised communities. Thank you, Jess. It was an absolute honour to talk to you. If you'd like to know more about the other work I do and the Women's Sport Collective, please visit fearlesswomen.co.uk. This is where you can find out more about all 58 of my incredible guests from this and the previous series, and you can also listen to all the podcasts from the website too. Previous trailblazing broadcasters and pundits include the likes of Claire Balding, Gabby Logan, Ellie Aldroyd, Ebony Rainford-Brent and Eni Aluko. Thanks again to Barclays for their kind support of the Game Changers, and also to Sam Walker from What Goes On Media, who does a great job as executive producer of the podcast. Do come and say hello on social media, where you'll find us on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram at The Game Changers or at Sue Anstis. Next week, I'll be talking to Dawn Scott, the woman who made Megan Rapinoe cry when she left her role with the US women's football team, having helped them to win 2 World Cups and Olympic gold. Dawn is now Senior Physical Performance Manager for the Lionesses and shares what it's like behind the scenes of elite women's sport.
For me, it's just about the exposure piece of if a girl in school can pick up something and see me or anybody as a female working in a role other than a participant in sport. I think that's the piece for me that makes me happy and satisfied at what I'm doing.
The Game Changers. Fearless women in sport.